Hi there, and welcome to a special edition of the Tennis Worthy podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame, and the sport of tennis is still breathing in the superb men's singles final at Roland Garros just a week ago, in which Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz played out a match for the ages. We've felt that this classic, alongside a major milestone for the American Coco Gauff the day before in a less memorable but equally significant women's final, warranted a special discussion to help us all digest a quite superb finals weekend. So we've brought together three long-standing and passionate tennis watchers, Chris Bowers, Blair Henley, and Joel Drucker, to discuss why the culmination of this year's Roland Garros was so significant and to put their very own personal spin on a memorable weekend.
One of the things that makes a greatest match, or a match that is comparable with the greatest matches ever, is a clash of styles. And I think we have that with Sinner and Alcaraz.
Like, I think in tennis, sometimes the weapon is doubt, and that's what Alcaraz is all about. It's like, what's he going to do? What's going to happen? And sometimes the weapon is knowledge. I mean, Sinner's thing is, I don't care if you know.
It transcended our tennis bubble, and that is what we want as followers and lovers of this game.
We all know the history of tennis is filled with many, many excellent matches. But for it to reach magic, I think you need mostly three things that happen.
Chris chaired the discussion, so his is the first voice you'll hear. Enjoy.
Well, what an amazing finals weekend it was, capped off by that 5-hour, 29-minute match in which Carlos Alcaraz came back from three match points down in the fourth set to beat Jannik Sinner in five. What a rivalry they have. But let's not also forget the women's match. Alongside me, Joel Drucker and Blair Henley. You've both seen lots of finals. Let's start with you, Joel. What do you think makes that particular Sinner-Alcaraz final such an amazing event? The term that's been used over the last few days is an instant classic. What have you been telling your friends about why it was an instant classic?
Well, what's so fun about it at the big level, it's kind of, I've talked to tennis people all around the world, and it's kind of like we were all at the same concert together, and we all got to partake in this thing, and it creates this communal thing of just transcendently great tennis. And I was thinking, I have a friend, this friend of mine is named Lena. She teaches art, and she says to her students often, she says, that painting was excellent, but it wasn't magical. And we know the history of tennis. We all know the history of tennis is filled with many, many excellent matches. But for it to reach magic, I think you need mostly three things that happen. You need a high-stakes occasion, such as a major singles final, sometimes Davis Cup or Billie Jean King Cup, but really a major singles final. Then you need two top contenders, often the two best in the world or close enough. And then the third part is some incredible drama and quality tennis. So all of those added up, and you suddenly saw, I mean, the three championship points that Alcaraz faced, the ebbs and flows as the match continued, all these things, and that creates the magic and the high quality of the tennis. So it's just incredibly, I called it in the story I wrote, divine creation. I mean, it was really something incredible.
Blair, Joel getting onto his criteria for, you know, what makes a great match. Why was it great for you?
Yeah, I liked this thought exercise, Chris. Thanks for making me think about it in this way, because you're right. We've heard so many people from so many different corners of the sports world talk about why the men's and the women's finals were both fantastic. But thinking about why they are all-time greats is a really interesting, again, thought exercise. So for me, there was the narrative going in, right? The fact that these two players at the top of the game had never played in a Grand Slam final before, despite playing 11 times prior to that Roland Garros final. And then there's the match itself. The match had drama, it had intrigue, it had momentum shifts, it had quality tennis. And then that match set tennis up moving forward, because now there are these questions. Are these two players, have they separated from the pack on the men's side? What are the narratives on the women's side? And then finally for me, and this is maybe the biggest one, because we all work in tennis, we want to see tennis succeed. And we know that we're the tennis nerds, right? But we would love for our friends who are like, wait, what do you do again? What is it that you do when you go to these tennis tournaments? We love it, or I love it when they say to me, oh my gosh, that final in Paris, I think it was in Paris, right? On the red clay, that was epic. And this match on the men's side, and again on the women's side as well, because Coco has such a cultural impact in addition to what she does on the tennis court, it transcended our tennis bubble. And that is what we want as followers and lovers of this game.
You see, I've been through this exercise as well, in particular when people say, well, what are the greatest matches in the history of tennis? And for me, there has to be something just a little bit more than the tennis match. I mean, one thinks of Ash against Connors in the Wimbledon final of 1975, when Connors was suing Ash as the president of the ATP. That had something extra. I would even put in there the Sampras Courier quarterfinal at the Australian Open in 1995, because that was when it suddenly came out to the world that Pete Sampras's coach had an inoperable brain tumour. The actual detail didn't come out that night, but to see Pete Sampras crying his eyes out. Now, we didn't have that extraneous drama with Sinner against Alcaraz. It was more the Borg-McEnroe Wimbledon final of 1980, which was just pure drama. But I think one of the things that makes a greatest match, or a match that is, you know, comparable with the greatest matches ever, is a clash of styles. And I think we have that with Sinner and Alcaraz. And OK, one's from Spain and one's from Italy, both southern European countries. But actually, Sinner is from that German-speaking enclave in the very northern part of Italy. And I don't want to get too much into stereotypes about the sort of the dry German against the flamboyant Latin Mediterranean. But there is something about them. You know, Sinner is a dry, systematic tennis player. Alcaraz has the flair. That's why I think Alcaraz goes through phases where he's not as consistent as we expect him to be. And for me, that clash of styles is something that's so important for the attractiveness of tennis, and why for me tennis needs Alcaraz, it needs Musetti, it needs other players who do something a little bit different. But that for me was the optimistic part of it. We have not just a rivalry of two great guys at the top of the game, but a clash of styles.
Well, the style clash, and you mentioned Borg-McEnroe 1988, and I, writing about it, thought about other great matches of the Open era. And in a way, you would see Sinner in more of the Borg role, of the more, focused, and he kind of hunkers down, and he just, and his game, there's a linear quality to Sinner's game. It reminds me somewhat of Djokovic, the same way, that way. Or it also reminds me of Chris Evert in a men's game, very, you know, metronomic and disciplined. And Alcaraz has more of what McEnroe had. Things occur to him. He finds ways to sort of put together sequences, and to see those in conflict with one another. Yeah, that's the fun part of watching tennis, is style contrasts, right? And so as a result, you're going to see a lot of points played differently. I mean, we've all been in finals, major finals, where you watch the first 10 minutes, you say, okay, I see. This is where we're going to be settling 3 hours, 4 hours. This is how every point's going to, I won't mention any names, but we've all seen them. And then when you see the contrast, now it's fun. They're going to be different rallies. That's what makes it fun.
And for that reason, for me, there was never a bad match between Evert and Navratilova, because contrast in styles was so good that even when one of them was struggling and the other one was dominant, there was always a good match. Are we actually also underestimating the fact that the conditions were perfect for tennis? For the men's singles final, they were pretty awful for the women's. And are we, in fact, slightly underselling Coco Gauff's achievement, her second Grand Slam, because that match was all about how do you make the best of incredibly difficult tennis conditions, when actually I think she won that match out of just being the smarter player on the day.
Yeah, I think it underscores what we know Coco Gauff does so well. She can dig. There was, I think, at one point during the United Cup, the Team USA had the motto of we're just digging. They were drawing shovels on the lenses of the cameras after they finished a match. And that is what Coco Gauff does so well. And those conditions set her up to do what she does and to frustrate Aryna Sabalenka in a way that I don't think any other player frustrates her. Andrea Petkovic summed it up so incredibly well. She said that Coco Gauff, A, recognizes short balls faster than anyone else, so she takes time away from you in that way. But because she can dig, elite level digging, she forces you to go for shots that you otherwise might not go for. So yes, did Aryna Sabalenka have 70 unforced errors according to the stat sheet? She did. But is that because she felt like she had to be 2 inches away from the sideline in order to hit a shot that was going to win the point? Also, probably yes. So I think that it was special in its own way because you got to see the pure grit from both of those players.
Well, that match made me think of my longstanding concept, and you hinted at, Blair, there might not be any such thing as an unforced error. Mm. I mean, in a way, Goff's speed compelled that miscue. And as far as that match goes, that was a great tribute to what a competitor is. No one in tennis competes better than Coco Gauff. And by compete, I don't mean necessarily attaining outcomes, though she wins plenty. She just won her second major, as much as the process of point to point, every way she maintained her concentration and focus. It reminded me of, to go back in the history books, a Hall of Famer, Tracy Austin, 1981 U.S. Open Final. Windy day. She's playing Martina Navratilova. And Martina wins the first set 6-1 in about 10 minutes. And Tracy just digs in. And if you watched the way Tracy was managing herself in between points, it was just like Coco Gauff, like here to the next problem. And there was no real energy spiking. And you see Sabalenka in this case, she's a great player too. I mean, she's already won 3 majors and I suspect she'll win more. She's serving at 4-1, 40 love, double faults, and she's already upset. I don't know about you guys. We all play. If I'm serving now at 4-1, 40, 15, still got to feel I'm in pretty good shape.
Yeah, but I think this was the point with Sabalenka, is that because she likes the clean conditions, she was ready to be upset.
Yes.
Almost by herself. And that's why her slightly uncharitable comments at the end, which I don't think were as uncharitable as they've sometimes been painted as. I think she was just frustrated with herself. But, you know, when you're being thwarted by a gusting wind, by a court that's been watered just before the match, it's drying out, but it's not, you know, it's still quite heavy conditions. And then she misses a couple of shots she would normally make. When a ball then comes off your opponent's racket, off the frame and lands in, it does do damage to you. You know, it does throw you off your own rhythm. And I think that's what happened with Sabalenka. She'll come back stronger from this, but this is where I actually think Gauff won that on pure mentality, because Sabalenka hits a better ball than Gauff.
Navratilova, who won 4 U.S. Opens after that loss, said to me, "You know, in tennis, you can only control 2 things, your toss and your attitude." And we began Roland Garros with the tribute to Rafael Nadal. And so you think, what would Rafa do? And what would Uncle Tony have done if Rafa, when he was 10 years old, said, "You know, I play this match, I play this guy on a windy day, and he kept getting all these balls." And Uncle Tony said, "Hey, meet your new best friend. We're gonna play him for the next 14 days. That's what you're gonna do. And by the way, where's the windiest place in Spain where we can do that? So you can work on that."
Yeah, and control the controllables, which is one of those cliches. Back to the Sinner-Alcaraz match. To what extent do you think that the final in Rome, 3 weeks beforehand, played a part in that? Because that was one where Sinner had the better of the first set, but Alcaraz snuck it at the end. And Sinner seemed to melt away in the second set as Alcaraz gained confidence. In a way, it was like the fourth and fifth sets of the Roland Garros final.
That's a tough call. I almost felt like it was more of a clean slate than you might have thought, given the fact that they had just played each other, you know, a few weeks before. What did you think, Joel?
Well, that was their one. And there was also one last fall. I believe it was it Beijing or Shanghai? They had a great final there, and Sinner had led in that one. Yeah, I guess you could see in history, we'll see Rome as kind of the prologue, as an early version of it. But it's just, you know, it's just so hard and tense. What was so great about this match, when Sinner was in control, he seemed impregnable. Like, how is he going to lose? Look, he's got it. He's got it going. He's hitting deep, hard, and repeatedly compromising Alcaraz. then Alcaraz would be in control, and he's the one with the more variety. It's like, I think in tennis, sometimes the weapon is doubt, and that's what Alcaraz is all about. It's like, what's he going to do? What's going to happen? And sometimes the weapon is knowledge. I mean, Sinner's thing is, I don't care if you know. I'm hitting the ball hard and deep into that corner and that corner. I mean, that's in, you know, Ellsworth Fiennes, Don Budge, Lindsay Davenport. That's what made these players great. So, God, I just...
Maybe we're reading too much into head-to-heads here, because, I mean, don't forget, these guys knew each other on the junior circuit. I'm reminded of a comment that Jim Courier once said about Andre Agassi, which I had to ask him about, because it's a comment that you could easily misinterpret. He said, I've seen Andre in his underpants. Now, what he meant by that was they've shared locker rooms as juniors, and therefore there was no fear factor. And when Alcaraz was dominating in the early days of their rivalry, Sinner wasn't worried, because he says, OK, this guy's just a kid I knew on the junior circuit. So I don't think there's a fear there anymore. Although it's interesting that Alcaraz has won the last few matches that they've played.
Yeah, the last five, which is significant given that Sinner has, what, won his last 47, something like that, against anyone else, which is pretty impressive. So I do think that has the potential with every successive win for Alcaraz to, again, instill doubt, as Maxime Cressy famously wrote in his notebook that he would read on changeovers. One of the few surviving serve and volleyers of our day. That was his motto, was instill doubt in the opponent. And I do think that little by little, that a little bit of that doubt could be sliding in there for Sinner when he plays Alcaraz.
It's so hard that when you have 3-5, love 40 in the fourth set, so you're thinking, is that a... It doesn't appear to be a strategic issue. You know, it's not an operating system issue. It's more of a execution thing. And we're going to be micro studying those 3 points forever about what happened on those points and the things that happened.
Okay, so ask the question. What did happen at 3-5, love 40?
Well, I think at that first one, there's a chance for Sinner to gain the initiative, and he didn't quite grab it.
First one was an unforced error. The second were semi-unforced.
Well, I think this is the interesting thing about that dynamic. It wasn't purely unforced the way a sitter is. I think the one that's probably most tricky was the 15-40. Second serve return to Sinner's backhand. And he, you know, that's a ball you'd say you need to get that in play somehow. You need to at least start the rally against an opponent who's down championship points. And he hit it, what was that, about 18 inches long?
I didn't think it was that long, but it was clearly long, but not by much. But yeah, second serve return. I mean, one of the things that a number of commentators and reporters were saying, they were bringing up this figure of 3 hours, 48 minutes, because Sinner has not won a match that's gone over 3 hours, 48. Now, at one level, that's just a bit of statistic nonsense, because, you know, someone's looked at the longest match that Sinner has won. But I know that certain commentators in the final were saying, we're getting up to that 3 hours, 48 minute mark, beyond which it might be a challenge for Sinner. Is there an issue, or are we just imposing statistics on a naturally organic battle of two human beings?
Well, as someone who's worked, I call myself sometimes the, let's form the International Data Nugget Commission. And I see these numbers, it's like, whatever. I mean, I don't find that particularly interesting when that's said. It's like, okay, it's just about Alcaraz. You know, Sinner hasn't had to play a 3 hour and 49 minute match versus another people. Should he be punished? Should he drop a set in the third round of Australia? See, I did it. I won a 4 hour match. Because I don't think there was any, it was more about nerves and Alcaraz's ability to kind of like come up with different things at different times. I think that's kind of the, that's the thing that Alcaraz does. And that's the thing, one of the things I try to study is what makes the super great players super great at moments. And one thing I've come up with from research over the years, going back to Laver and Connors and even back to Gonzalez, they come up with something at the late stage that you hadn't seen that's surprising. And what that does, that doesn't just win them 1 point, it wins them 10 points. Because now it's sort of like I've yanked the tablecloth out from the dinner party. And I think a lot of great, great, excellent players are pattern players. I mean, Sinner strikes you as more of a pattern player than Alcaraz.
Okay, but Joel, you know how if a player has a weakness, it spreads like wildfire through the locker room and player lounges. Are the players on the men's tour going to be saying, actually, at slams, get Sinner into a fifth set because he doesn't last as well as some?
I don't think so. What do you think, Blair?
Well, first of all, I think if players could get Sinner to a fifth set at will, they'd be jumping at the chance. Like, sure, let me just get him to a fifth set and then I've got a shot.
How about a fourth set?
Or a fourth set, right, exactly. But one thing that I think plays into the narrative of this match going in, that also plays into the question of can Sinner win a match longer than 4 hours, was the fact that he had only played one tournament since the Australian Open. He was not match fit. So the fact that he was able to, and he said in press, he did not feel like he lost the match because of his fitness. He felt, granted, they both looked tired. There were moments. There was a moment after a drop shot that Sinner really looked a little bit hobbled in the fifth. But he said in press he did not feel physically compromised beyond normal fatigue. But again, I think that is a piece of it too, that Sinner had not played matches. And that is a huge part of feeling like you can go forever in those situations.
And he came within 2 points of winning the title at 6-5 in the fifth.
Exactly.
Right. So I don't think there was like a particular physical issue. I think he got just kind of outplayed. And I don't know. I mean, how do you go about reviewing a match where you have three straight championship points? Well, this is what I need to change. It's like sort of like the hands of the gods, because you tell me if you guys thought that. I thought at the beginning of the fifth, oh, Alcaraz, now he's got it, and it's gonna run away and win at 6-2, a little bit like what Agassi did when he beat Medvedev in that 1999 Roland Garros final. What did you guys think?
Well, I think you raise a question of the comeback, because a lot of the journalists that reported on the Sinner-Alcaraz final said, well, it was one of the greatest comebacks ever. Well, was it greater than Agassi coming back from two love down in the 99 final? What about the 2004 final where Gaston Gaudio had won three games and was in an hour and was 6-love, 6-3 down, or 6-3, 6-love down, ended up winning it, having saved a match point? How great a comeback was it? I mean, your question is valid, Joel. I don't think Sinner needs to beat himself up about missing those three match points, and I'm sure he will probably turn the tables on somebody else. But to me, was this a great... It was a great comeback, but was it the greatest?
It's a great comeback if you're serving a 3-5 love 40. I mean, winning, coming back from love 40 in any game is difficult, much less championship points. So I think that I'm not gonna rank it above the others. I think the Gaudio one was pretty impressive too, but there was a certain kind of Gaudio had in that match, a certain kind of almost fatalism, like, hey, I won a game now, I'm on the board. And so there's a whole different sense as opposed to the tight ebbs and flows of this match, even though Alcaraz lost the first two sets. But again, three straight championship points, we'd have to look pretty deep to find that scenario.
What do you guys think the legacy of this match would have been had Sinner gotten it done on one of those match points? I think it would have been a meh final. What do you guys think people would have thought?
Well, yes, I agree with you on that. It would have been a meh final. But for me, we've had this situation for about a year now where, in my view, we've had two world number ones. We've had a hard court world number one, and we've had a natural surface, grass and clay number one. And had Sinner won, I think you'd have blown that theory out of the water, because you'd say, no, this guy's the best in the world and it doesn't matter what surface he's playing on. Now, if he wins Wimbledon, maybe you can say the same thing. But for me, the fact that Alcaraz came back from the brink to win using more varied clay court tennis means, for me, Sinner is still without question the best in the world on hard. But not necessarily on clay, and jury's still out on grass.
So if Sinner wins in four sets, it's kind of okay. It also, though, remember, it puts Sinner then halfway towards the calendar slam.
Ooh.
And on to Wimbledon to try to topple Alcaraz, who's won it the last 2 years. So then it makes Wimbledon is very intriguing, period. But that would have cast in a different light, maybe given Alcaraz a certain urgency about wow, he's got to win three straight. He's going to take away my Wimbledon title. Is Sinner that impregnable now that he's proven himself on clay? And I like your split, Chris, between the hard court and, let's say, the natural surfaces, because clay, thanks to string technology, is faster. Grass, thanks to grass technology, is slower. So the whole Paris-London sequence isn't as wide a gap as it once was in, let's say, the Bjorn Borg era. It's narrower. But now Sinner, now he's got to think, Wimbledon and Alcaraz. You're right, it's fun, and that's what makes the rivalry fun, the ebbs and flows, mm-hmm. each vying. I like the idea of them being the co-number ones.
But Blair, what do you think about the legacy of the match had Sinner won?
I tend to think that Carlos is more relatable as a human to the rest of us, not in the sense that we can relate to his otherworldly ability, but just the joy, the smiling. He connects in a way that Sinner doesn't quite. And I think my interest is always in pushing tennis beyond the tennis bubble. And I think that the way that it ended for that particular aspect of things couldn't have been any better. A, there's the relatability of Carlos, and he smiles and he connects with the crowd. And there's also the fact that the match itself was unbelievable. I don't know if you guys saw the tweet. Somebody took a photo of Carlos on the court with clay all over his back. I think the photo might have been from after he won, but they put up the score line of when he was down 3-5, love 40, and said, I'm going to hang this on my wall and look at it anytime I think something is impossible. And it's got, you know, gotten millions of views over on Twitter/X. But I think that piece of it, there's just nothing. It's irreplaceable. It's such a great thing, not only for tennis, but for sports and for Carlos and his legacy. So I think it was great the way that it ended. I just feel like it certainly wouldn't have had the impact that it did had it ended in straights.
Which leads me to a question I'd like to throw at you, Joel, because you wrote a book about Jimmy Connors. Connors was the guy known for absolute never say die attitude. However adrift he was in a match, he would always believe he could fight his way out. Do you see the qualities that Connors had in Alcaraz, in this ability to come back from a seemingly hopeless situation in the goldfish bowl of global publicity?
Oh, absolutely. I think Connors loved that. I think Connors created a template that Alcaraz has inherited without even knowing it. I mean, Connors is tennis's first rock star. You know, they're all great players before Connors, but I think of them all as they were crooners. They were great singers. Connors was the one who kind of broke through the wall and said, come on in, join me for the ride. Now, granted, there was a whole other pathology of Connors that's different than Alcaraz in relating to umpires and officials and opponents and many others. And Connors would agree to that. But the notion of like, hey, everyone, like, I bet you, let's help me beat this guy. You gotta, and let's come along. And the energy Connors would draw from a great rally, the ones that he would win, but even sometimes the ones he would lose, and the whole sense of him and of him connecting with the crowd that way. And that's why I think Sinner's more in the Borg role, and that's okay too. Of I'm gonna hunker down. I'm not gonna let this isn't here to intrude on me. And it's all this stuff about hard wiring and personalities and where we draw energy from. Connors, early in his career, didn't care if you hated him or loved him. He just wanted you to connect with him, to have a connection. And he didn't, sure, hate me, love me. And then he had, at a certain stage of his career, kind of an epiphany. And I think he realized, wait a second, why should they hate me? If they love me, they'll help me win more. And he began to use it to his favor. And Alcaraz, now we're in an era where we're 40, 50 years past Connors. So it's more Alcaraz. It's like, let me take joy in the game. You could see a line from Connors to Nadal to Alcaraz. You know, the shots, the rallies, the sequences. It's fantastic. And I think from a crossover standpoint, it draws people to the game too, because it's not about the technical data that we know about grips and doubt and tactics and things. It's just like, whoa, shots. I mean, it's also kind of what Roger Federer had about, I don't need to understand tennis at all to see, wow, this is amazing.
But when you had Connors, there were 50% of the people were saying, wow, this guy's great. And 50% were saying, I admire his fighting spirit, but I'd be very happy for him to lose. I defy anybody not to want Alcaraz to do well, because he just radiates joy.
He's the people's choice. In American sports, you would have gone back to the baseball player Willie Mays, or in basketball, Magic Johnson. It's an infectious joy. I heard a story the day he played the first Wimbledon final, Alcaraz said, "This is going to be the best day of my life." He hadn't even played the match yet.
How does Alcaraz go down in America? Because I still think that Goff doesn't quite go down as well outside America as she does within America. So in a way, we've got two similar champions here in Alcaraz and Goff, who are very big in their own continents. But how big are they outside?
I think they're big. As tennis players go, I think, and we haven't, again, it's so funny that we were all, I mean, I think there were many of us who worked in tennis who were thinking like, what are we going to do now that Serena is gone, now that the big three are near, you know, before they have retired and are nearing the end, or the big four. And now here we are with Coco going to a New York Liberty game, a WNBA game, and getting a standing ovation. She's being interviewed by Stephen A. Smith. She's on, you know, late night with Jimmy Fallon and doing TikToks with him. I think it's definitely possible that she resonates more in the U.S. than outside the U.S., but I think she is one of the biggest stars we've ever seen in tennis.
Yeah, the second slam, as we know from our Hall of Fame work in history, that kind of exponentially validates her significance, right? Because now she's earned a second, and I think it's harder to earn the second. It's harder to earn the second than the third, right? To get that second slam, and I think Alcaraz, I find people enjoy him in America. I mean, his attitude, his shot making, his skills. I also think though. I have friends who don't follow tennis that much, and they love telling me what tennis needs. And I finally said to them, "You know, I'm sick of you talking about my sport like it's on a deathbed. It's in a hospital. Don't tell me what tennis needs. You know, it just is. It just is."
But I'm going to go back to the point I made about the greatest matches. For me, it takes something a little bit extra.
Absolutely.
I actually think that Goff is the best thing for tennis, not just for women's tennis, for tennis. And I say to so many people, if you don't know it, go and look on one of the online video services and look up her Black Lives Matter speech from the, was it early months of 2020? Because she was, what, 16 at the time? And the composure that she had, and her interviews on court when she got to the Roland Garros final in 2022, when she was still only, well, she's still a teenager. Her poise, her composure, her ability to see the aspects of life that really matter, to understand, actually, that tennis is only a game and that there are far more important things to worry about. For me, that makes her into a sporting stateswoman. And I don't think that is appreciated outside America.
I would agree with that. Can I add one other aspect to that? I think she does that while also connecting incredibly well. And I would say the same goes for Carlos with young people. She is on social media. She is chronically online. She is making the TikToks about how big the Roland Garros trophy actually is that the players get to take home, that went ultra viral. So she, yes, has this incredible maturity, but also connects with young people. That has been a problem for tennis, sort of. Again, chronically, is tennis struggles to connect with the younger generation. Aryna Sabalenka also does that really, really well. And yes, part of it is because they sort of buy in and enjoy being online and creating content. Yes, that is part of it. But I think that piece of it for Carlos also, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the video of him tiptoeing up to the ball kids and then jumping up and down with all of them after a 5.5 hour match. I'm like, I would have been in a full body cramp. And he is essentially playing with children after this match is over. So I think that that is a huge piece of the overall appeal.
That reminds me of the Federer, always the ball boys and ball girls at the Basel tournament. Did he buy the pizza? Did he have like a pizza thing at the end of that?
Yes.
And players doing those things, I think that's really, it's not giving back. It's just enjoying that this is a game and this is fun. As far as Goff, yeah, I think she's transformational. I think she's going to, in America in particular, she's going to become even more significant in many ways in the years to come. Around the world, with tennis players and the sport, it's really complicated to understand how they connect in different countries and different continents. I mean, I wrote a piece a few years ago about McEnroe's relationship to England, and based on research I'd done and talking to some people, and why McEnroe clicked in England differently than Connors. But in a way, that stuff can be a real slippery slope. I'm sure if I sent it to you, Chris, you'd have corrected about 5 of my assumptions, you know, just as I would have you, just like I do with people talking about America and even California compared to the East Coast. So it's just, there's different ways and different ways at different stages in these players' lives, they register differently. I mean, how you look at Agassi, for example, and his whole transformational journey, right? From the image is everything to the substance to the, you know, the clothing and all these things, they evolve.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And in fact, Blair's point about social media, TikTok, and various other ways that today's younger generation communicate is actually very, very important to this. You know, we are, as tennis historians, we are of a certain generation, sort of by definition almost. My only real insight into how young people think is that I have a 23-year-old daughter who's not really into tennis. Any tennis interest she has is because she's been dragged screaming into it by her dad. But I will often say to her about a tennis player, have you seen this? Do you know about that? And it's interesting to see what comes up, because the people that transcend are not necessarily the people that we think transcend on the basis of their on-court performance.
Ask Pete Sampras. I mean, but this has been true. This has been true. And this is the thing with tennis. I mean, the ones who transcend outside the lines, and who the ones for whom pretty much the racket does the talking, and it's not even a function of playing style. I mean, for example, Chris Evert did that in America in a way that was harder for some of her other rivals and things. It's just different people at different times and places, and where the sport is in the culture at different phases.
Okay, I want to have a bit of fun here before we sort of start rounding this thing off. A lot of media folk have trawled the vocabulary of the great Spanish and Italian cultural icons. Alcaraz playing Picasso to Sinner's Michelangelo. Alcaraz's flamenco versus Sinner's grand opera and such like. Now, is this just the media getting into purple prose, or can one actually look at the match that was played on Sunday as having got into the artistic?
I think absolutely you can look at it that way. And that's why a match like this is so cool, because there are people willing to look at it from an artistic perspective, as well as kids watching who want to go buy a tennis racket because they're like, this looks so cool. So the fact that you have, why not? Why not look at it from that perspective? Because it's one of many that I think were a result of people watching that match.
Joel, you love your sort of cultural references, don't you, to tennis?
I do this a million times. I've compared each of the majors to the Beatles. I've written about chess and tennis. I could metaphor tennis into anything. I compare players.
Go on, then have some fun.
Well, I think Alcaraz is that restaurant that has an unbelievable set of things on the menu. All these different food items. Sinner's, it's kind of a little more straightforward. It's kind of it's kind of meat and potatoes, but it's a great cut of steak. That's what Sinner is. Wow. And it's probably, I guess, since it's Italy, I guess we'll go with some tiramisu. Alcaraz is like, what is this dessert? I never heard of this ever. It's just like the way I once compared, Federer was the prefix meal that, you know, was great. The three courses, and it was great. And the guy came with the one. And also it was the restaurant and this, I don't know, palazzo and terrace. Nadal was the hole in the wall place that you didn't know. The menu was like a one piece of paper. But boy, it was fantastic. And it was like this, where did this spaghetti sauce come from? So I think all this kind of cultural stuff is just, that's a fun way to bring language and actually to connect to broader audiences. Like the whole thing we did for years, the Federer was the Baryshnikov, Rafa was the Matador, all these kind of things. And so I think we're going to be looking for our metaphors for Sinner and Alcaraz. We knew they were distant from the pack before the tournament started, right? They were already, before the tournament started, they were clearly the 1 and 2. And this tournament kind of distanced them even further, don't you think?
I agree. But Blair, any favorite metaphors from gastronomy, from dance, from music?
Well, I have to say, Joel, the obvious menu that came to my mind when we think of Alcaraz is the Cheesecake Factory. It's the 50-page tome with you've got 27 different kinds of pasta. I mean, that's it. It's the prefix and the Cheesecake Factory menu. And listen, can you go to Cheesecake Factory and order something that may not be great? Yes. And I think even Carlos said that in press. He's like, they might not all be this good, because he could come out and, place more similarly to how he did the first 2.5, I don't know, maybe you could even say 3.5 sets of this match, because he's got all the different, he's got 27 different pastas to choose from.
It's a big paella with all the stuff, and Sinner's more straightforward. I don't know what the you probably heard the Cheesecake Factory, very popular place in the U.S., Chris, where you can't go wrong. But yeah, it's lots of stuff. Yeah.
But yes, the paella against the risotto, I suppose, isn't it?
Oh,
There you go.
nice. There you go. See, this is, but see, I think that stuff adds, as it were, adds spice to the menu of tennis options, and that's what makes it fun. I enjoy those things. It makes it colorful and paints pictures, and now you have things to write about and to connect with people about, and it just adds a lot of engagement.
Okay, so before we get too out in sort of, before people start wondering what we've been eating before we recorded this, let's just finish this off by saying, where does it leave tennis? I mean, are we going to expect too much from the next Sinner-Alcaraz final? Have they set the bar too high? What about other people in their wake? Will tournament directors say, we only want Sinner or Alcaraz, we don't want anybody else? Or where is this left women's tennis as well? So lots of questions.
Here's one thing I thought of. I was looking at other great matches. I had five great matches in the open era besides. I had 72 Lever Rosewall. I had 80 Borg McEnroe. 08 Nadal Federer Wimbledon. 12 Djokovic Nadal at the Australian Open. And the 19 Djokovic Federer Wimbledon final. What's interesting about these two have a combined age of 45. So, in a way, we're pretty much at the dawn. Borg and McEnroe had the same combined age at that time too. They were 24 and 21. But they, little did we know in 1980 that within 18 months, Borg would be feeling pretty world weary and eventually want out of tennis. So I think what's exciting about this is that this rivalry has just kind of begun. I don't think we're expecting too much. We're going to get what we're going to get. And if we don't get it, it's on us if we're disappointed. It's just going to be what it's going to be, and let's just see how it continues to play out. It's a great appetizer course for the next meal, hopefully at Wimbledon. That'd be nice, but I don't think, like, I don't write my stories kind of draw casting, like, oh, and all signs are pointed towards what could be this final. Let's just let the tennis happen as it happens and raise the bar for the rivals. It's like, the guy who wonder, like, Alexander Zverev has got to be thinking, I'm number three in the world, and 38-year-old Novak beat me that way in Roland Garros, and then Sinner beat him. Huh? What kind of work do I got to do? But so I think for tennis, it's magnificent.
I agree. While I do think the expectations are sky high exiting Roland Garros, I think that the tennis on court has caught up to the tennis cultural street cred at the moment, because tennis culturally has been having a moment with the release of the Challengers movie last year. It seems like every clothing company out there has a blah 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 tennis club, the brand name and a tennis club. There is tennis themed everything, even if the brand has nothing to do with tennis. But I have felt, even last year, I felt that, oh wow, there's all this stuff outside of tennis that's happening, and people are pulling from tennis imagery and nostalgia. But I didn't really feel like the buzz of what was happening on court matched that. And after this Roland Garros, I feel like it matched that. And we had a men's final and a women's final that were both extremely compelling in their own ways. Because if you think back, the men's major finals, the last several haven't been particularly compelling. The women's, I feel like, have. I thought Madison Keys winning in Australia was amazing for so many reasons. But yeah, I feel like the tennis on court is matching the cultural moment, and I hope tennis takes advantage.
Okay, so just sticking with the men for a second, what I hope is that we don't find that Sinner and Alcaraz don't work on other surfaces. I'm sure they would work on hard courts. We saw their amazing match, quarterfinal of the US Open 3 years ago. It finished at 3 o'clock in the morning. Alcaraz won it and went on to win the title, but Sinner had a match point in that. I remain to be convinced that their contrast in styles will work as well on grass, but I'd love to be proved wrong on that. What I hope doesn't happen is that on Grand Slam semi-finals day, or even Masters 1000 semi-finals day, when you get Sinner in one and Alcaraz in the other, and the first one goes and wins and the second one loses, people say, oh, we haven't got a Sinner Alcaraz final. I do think we need two or three other players in the mix so that it doesn't become dependent on Sinner and Alcaraz. And I really hope Musetti can be up there. I want a couple more flair players up there. I want someone like Sebi Korda to be up there if I'm beginning to lose a little bit of confidence in him. But just players who've got something a little bit extra so that whoever gets into finals, whether it's Sinner Alcaraz, whether it's one of them but not both, or whether it's neither, that there are really entertaining finals that we can expect, even though we know that not every time they'll deliver.
Well, you look for worthy contenders, and you mentioned Sebi Korda, who I'm a little with you on that too. But I think Tommy Paul, Ben Shelton, Jack Draper. I mean, these guys have made their inroads, and yeah, the bar has been set. Gentlemen, rise to it, and so we'll see. It's great tennis. You know, I know the whole thing where it's like, oh, I didn't get the final, what I hope for. Well, it's not supposed to be about the final you hope for. You know, I've been around this sport for 50 years, and that whole thing about, oh, I want this. That's why it's sports. That's why it's sports. I mean, it's like once upon a time, everybody was nobody. Once upon a time, people hadn't heard of those four guys from Liverpool. So you just got to let it play out. And if he's in the final, by dint of having to get to the final, he's a worthy finalist. And I think, again, we put our hopes on these younger ones. It's a little.
But you're speaking as a tennis fan rather than a sports marketing agent.
No, but you know what? But I'm speaking, right? But I'm not invested in the economic future of the game that way. I think my job is to engage with the game and see it, rather than think of it like I'm a studio executive hoping to script what can be the economic salvation of the sport. I mean, that's
Okay.
it. Just let it happen, and it's gonna be what it's be, and it's okay. Okay, the game.
And at the top of the women's game, we now have, well, this isn't borne out by the current rankings, but in my view, we have three players. We have Goff, we have Sabalenka, and we have Swiatek. I know she is slightly off form on her best surface. I suspect she'll come good again. Or do you think there's somebody else who, in the next couple of years, will be in that a regular in the top five?
Yes. I think if there's one thing we've seen on the WTA side, it's that I mean, who saw Alex Iala coming, for instance? I think that, Victoria Mboko from Canada has been an incredible story. I think you just absolutely never know. I'll be interested to see if Elena Rybakina, even going into grass, where she has obviously been amazingly good. Can she bring back some of that magic? Can she find her sparkle again? So many questions going into grass season. But in terms of the larger narrative and the players that aren't the players at the very top, I think that's where those of us who work in media have a job to do, and it's to help people understand why there are so many other compelling stories, game styles, personalities that are out there, and explain to people why these things are amazing. I mean, I think back to Miami this year. I was there. Archer Fils played Francis Tiafoe on Grandstand Court, which is a temporary stadium, so it's all metal. And it was one of the most raucous atmospheres. I mean, it was so funny because you know that both of those guys have professional athletes of other sports who come watch them. And they're out in the metal stands of Grandstand, and there's like rows of famous people up out on Grandstand in Miami. But that was one of the most incredible matches I've seen courtside in quite some time. I mean, you had Archer Fils breaking rackets, Francis doing his thing to the crowd. those things happen in every tournament. It might not be happening in the final, but I think that those types of matches happen in every tournament. It's just a matter of helping people understand that there is amazing tennis and amazing drama to be seen, even if it's not happening by, you know, with Carlos and Jannik.
All metal and the heavy metal.
Exactly.
They gave something very electric, and that gets people very excited about what it can be. And then you see, the women's game. You know, I think there was an effort in the last couple of years, I think, to kind of like find the next big three. Like, that's a mandatory thing to exist. And I do know, though, like I've said to people, the species organizes in threes. You know, the Holy Trinity, the Kingston Trio.
Okay, so who's the third in the men? I've given you three names in the women.
But I don't think there's need for any of that there. I think Iga, I think she's in some real, she had a partial redemption in Paris by reaching that semi and playing some good tennis along the way to beat Rybakina and Svitolina. You know, look at Mira Andreeva. I mean, she's a young hopeful who got kind of a Hingis broad, wide game going, lots of tactics and tools she draws on. There doesn't need to be any. I don't know. Let's see how the results go. There doesn't need to be a three. It doesn't have to be that.
All right. Now then, I'm going to make three seem a big number, because I'm going to end this by asking both of you, and I'll do it myself as well, for one word to sum up Sinner versus Alcaraz on Sunday.
Magical.
I thought you'd say that because you said it earlier on. But very good. Blair?
Bonkers.
the word for me is spectacle, because in a way, you know, an event like that has to be a spectacle, and they delivered a spectacle in so many respects. Thank you so much to Joel Drucker and to Blair Henley. I'm Chris Bowers, and this has been a fascinating discussion because we had such wonderful material to work off, and let's hope we can do it again, because another final is as good as the one we've just seen last weekend.
What a fascinating discussion that was. All sorts of historical comparisons, an outline of what makes a great match, where Alcaraz and Goff's victories leave the top of professional tennis, and gastronomic metaphors galore, including Carlos and Jannik as cheesecakes. We hope that's both filled you up and left you wanting even more. And there is more on the Tennis Worthy podcast. Our next feature is a sparkling interview with one of a class of 2024 Hall of Famers, Leander Paes. That's in a few days, but don't forget to trawl through the archives to find all sorts of compilations, discussions, and interviews that will give you a different perspective on some aspect of tennis. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Join us again soon.